Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the research that takes a look at how it is that families are affected by the wide array of pressures that come to bear on them today, social and particularly economic pressures. And certainly we know that this kind of pressure can have a very profound influence on the way family members relate to one another, how they interact, and also how individual family members behave. Our guest for the program is Rand Conger. He is Distinguished Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of California, Davis. He's also a research collaborator with the title Professor of Psychology at Iowa State University. He's been a faculty member also at University of Georgia, here at U of I, Urbana-Champaign, and also Iowa State. He was here on our campus just about a month ago. He was here. His visit was sponsored by the folks at the Pamperchef Family Resiliency Program based over at Doris Kelly Christopher Hall. They periodically bring speakers in. We've had a number of them on the show, and unfortunately for our schedule, it just didn't work out for us to have Professor Conger on the program when he was here, but we really wanted to take some opportunity to talk with him, and he's good enough to be spending some time with us on the telephone. 333-9455 is the number. We'd like to get people involved in the conversation. If you'd like to call in, that's certainly great. We also do have a toll-free telephone number, and that means if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you certainly have questions, comments, you can pick up the telephone and be a part of the show. Professor Conger, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
I thought maybe we might talk a little bit first about the idea of resiliency. And I know that within your field, this is not exactly new. I'm not sure when people really started to think about this, but it seemed like at the time it represented a different kind of way of looking at family dynamics, and that based on the idea that you could look at families that in many respects are the same, had the same stressors on them, and in some families they weathered the stress pretty well, and others not. It can be very destructive. So the question that I think a lot of researchers took up was, well, why was that? And particularly for those families that did manage to weather the storm, what was different about them? Is taking that kind of approach, talking about something like resiliency, was that really a departure from the way that family dynamics and the stress on families had been studied before?
I think for about the last two decades now, researchers have been particularly interested in exactly the question that you've just asked, and that is, how do some families, and for that matter, how do some individuals who face very difficult circumstances in their lives, like economic hardship or an economic downturn, how do some of them manage to survive those kinds of challenges without much problem, while others are completely done in by experiencing these very difficult life situations? Yeah. In our own research, we've been following a group of families, and in particular a cohort of originally adolescents starting back in 1989 in rural areas of Iowa. And those young people are now grown to about 30 years of age. We've been able to follow their lives across time to see which ones of them, even in the face of difficult circumstances, have done pretty well. But in their families of origin, we were able to determine to some degree which families handled economic stresses and strains pretty well, and others who were very disrupted by such problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, and then we could talk about how you have moved out and looked at other families with different kinds of backgrounds, you know, demographically speaking. But it would seem to me that to have that kind of longitudinal data to be able to follow people from the point that perhaps they were adolescents all the way to the time when they were in their 30s, you don't often have that much long-term material to deal with. Was there something very specific when the project started out, some specific question that you were interested in exploring?
The issue that really prompted the study to begin with was the economic downturn in agriculture and economic downturn in the rural economy that occurred during the 1980s. The farm crisis is a shorthand term that many people use. But we were particularly interested in how these families of these adolescents would weather the storm of a very difficult economic time in rural America. And one of the things that we found, going back to your original question, one of the things that we found that was particularly important was the strength of the relationship between mothers and fathers. Even in very difficult circumstances, when mothers and fathers were able to maintain priorities in relation to the family itself, for example, when they could continue to communicate with each other without becoming angry and irritable, when they could continue to invest time and effort in the lives of their children, the children did very well, actually, even in economically difficult times, when the parents could hold it together in those kinds of ways. Not only that, but when parents could maintain effective communication and when they could continue to problem solve together, their relationship was better able to withstand the storm, and they were less likely to become extremely unhappy in their marriages or to even divorce or separate.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the basic things that you have found is if you look at, so this was Iowa families, and I'm presuming that these were mostly white people, and that what you did was you also looked, there have been studies looking at African-American families. I think now that you're in California, you've been involved in some studies looking at Mexican-American families, and sometimes people of different also economic levels, that in a sense all that stuff really doesn't matter, that the challenges can be the same, so it doesn't matter what kind of ethnic or racial background you come from, the stresses can be the same, the consequences can be the same, and then also if you look at what are the factors that seem to help, that contribute to resiliency, it seems that they're also the same.
That's true. What's been fascinating about this line of research is that we had real concerns that what we learned in rural Iowa might be unique to rural Iowa, and as you say, to families of European descent. But that work now has been replicated in several different places. For example, we have gone on to study African-American families in urban areas, and we've studied single-parent as well as two-parent families. Others in California, including ourselves, have begun to study families of Mexican origin. There have even been some replications of the original work outside the United States. There's a Finnish study, for example, that replicated very nicely our original findings, and even some work in Korea and around the world. And it looks like there's this very basic process that occurs. Significant stresses like economic pressures that families might face when somebody loses a job or there's a severe downturn in a local economy, those kinds of stresses and strains have their first major impact on parents, on adults. And those adults will tend to become depressed. They'll tend to experience feelings of anger and irritability and anxiety, reasonably enough, when your livelihood is threatened and your ability to support your family is threatened. And it's how they handle those kinds of feelings and how in their relationships they manage either to hold it together or to succumb to the pressures it really makes a difference in terms of their own lives and the lives of their children.
Hmm. Was that something that particularly this, as you say, the understanding that when these kinds of pressures come to bear on families, the ones that perhaps experience it first are the parents, and how it is they handle it, how it is they relate to one another, determines to a great extent how well the family does, and then how the family members interact, and then that maybe also, particularly when you have adolescents, if they're going to manifest problem behaviors, that this is all bound up together. Was that something that for the people who were involved in the research was a surprise, was it that you just went into it not being exactly sure what you would find?
We had ideas from earlier research, particularly research that was conducted during the Depression years of the 1930s, some 60, well, I don't know how long ago is that now. That's 60 or 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time, there were a number of small studies that showed that economic problems could be very disruptive of family interactions and family environments. But the research was fairly limited. It tended to be more ethnographic in the sense that it involved small numbers of interviews with small numbers of families. But we extended the work to a very large number of families, over 500 families, and looked at these issues much more systematically and over a longer period of time than had been done before. But we supported much of the earlier work that was done during the 1930s. One thing that stood out in our findings, though, that had not been found earlier was the fact that the mothers were equally involved in this family economic stress process as the fathers. Earlier research had tended to show that it was fathers who became unemployed who were especially likely to become angry and alienated and create difficulties in the family. We found that wasn't true, at least not with contemporary families. That the depressed mood that often visited mothers in these situations played an equally important part in potentially undermining the life of the family.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who's just tuned in. We're talking with Rand Conger. He's Distinguished Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of California, Davis, research collaborator with the title Professor of Psychology at Iowa State. He's also been on the faculty here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking about some of the research that he has been involved in now going back a couple of decades, really, starting with research on rural families living in Iowa who were dealing with the downturn in the farm economy. They have been able to follow some of these people over quite a long period of time to see how they have done long term. They have also done different kinds of studies looking at different kinds of families. For example, this first study was with European American families living in rural areas. Well, they've also looked at African American families in urban areas. They've done some work in California looking at Mexican American families, trying to look at different kinds of families with different kinds of backgrounds and ask some of the same basic questions about how it is they cope with stress, particularly economic stress, how that affects the relationships between family members, and then trying to get at this bigger question about why it is that some families can weather that stress pretty well and others not. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana for people who might like to join the conversation. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. If you take a look at these adults and look at how it is they relate to one another, and particularly those who do it in a more productive way. That is, you know, the stress doesn't break them apart, and then that gets visited on the family. Did you try to get at or have the opportunity to talk with people about how they learned the approach that they had? And was this a case of, it was, in a sense, it was just luck that those people had the personality and the perseverance and the skills to weather that? Was it because could they have said something like, well, that's the way my parents were, and that's how I learned by watching them. The basic question is, well, is this learned behavior? Can you say where it was learned, or would you have to say, well, I'm not really quite sure how it is that these people learned to cope the way that they did?
One of the fascinating things about being able to look at families over such a long period of time is we're beginning to address the very questions that you just raised. For example, if we take the original youth in the study, the 500 and some young people who were early adolescents when the research began, we're now able to follow them in their new families that they've established since they've moved into their 20s and soon into their 30s. And because we followed them when they were adolescents in their families of origin, we can now follow them in their new families that they've established as adults. And so we're able to ask the question, where does it come from? Where does it come from, a kind of interactional style that one engages in with a spouse or a romantic partner that promotes the stability of the relationship, that promotes the supportiveness that two people demonstrate toward one another? Mm-hmm. And it does seem to come to a significant degree from the family of origin. And we originally thought that exactly your answer would be the answer we would find, and that is that we would find that we learn how to be spouses and we learn how to be romantic partners by observing our parents. That doesn't seem to be the case. It does seem to be the case, however, that you learn how to treat other people in interactions with your parent. If your parent expects you to behave in a civilized way and treats you with respect and supports your efforts at engaging in social and civilized behaviors, you tend to carry forward those lessons in your interactions with other people as an adult, including a romantic partner, a spouse, and so on. And those tendencies to behave in that way toward other people put you in a good situation in terms of having to deal with stresses and strains later in your life, because you can then draw on the strengths of the relationship that has been established because of your own contributions to it when it comes time to have to deal with stressful life situations. So it looks like we do learn how to behave well in close relationships, and much of that learning comes from parent-child interactions in our families of origin, even more so perhaps than from observing what our parents do toward one another.
I think that's very interesting, because I would have expected, and I'm sure that a lot of people would expect, that I don't want to take anything away from the importance of the relationship between the parent and the child, but I would have thought, well, you asked this question, how is it that we as men and women learn about how men and women are supposed to behave and how they're supposed to relate to each other and how husbands and wives relate to each other? Well, it would be natural to say, well, how else would we learn but by watching our own parents? And that would be our own study project right there. We would be with them all the time and with the opportunity to watch them, and we learn from them interacting. And I suppose there is something to that, but I do think that it's very interesting that this finding that, well, that may indeed be important, but that what is more important is how is the parent-child relationship.
That's right. It's interesting, because I've just given you the sense that it's the parent-child relationship and not the marital relationship, and in a way that's true. It really comes down to a technical issue that we deal with in these kinds of research studies, and that is we talk about direct and indirect effects. If we look at the direct relationship between parent-child interactions in the family of origin and the way children, when they're grown up, treat their romantic partners, we find a direct relationship between parent-child interaction and later interactions with a romantic partner. If we enter what we observe in the marital relationship of the original parents, it does not relate directly to how the child grown up treats a romantic partner. However, it does tend to influence parent-child interactions. So it looks like if the marriage in the family of origin is a good one, if parents in the family of origin treat each other well, they tend also to function better as parents. They interact better with their children. So it's not that the marital relationship is unimportant. It's that it doesn't have the same immediate direct impact on how kids grow up to treat romantic partners. It has an indirect relationship through its effect on parent-child interactions.
I suppose one of the big questions for people who do this kind of research does have to do, sooner or later, I guess we get around thinking about intervention, in the sense that if you have a family that is having problems, that is not functioning well, is it possible for through counseling or education or whatever to try to give people some skills that will help? Is this the kind of thing, say we're talking about successfully weathering very stressful times, economic or otherwise, is that the kind of thing that can be taught? Can you give someone a toolkit of interpersonal skills that can make it possible for people to do better under those circumstances?
I believe that you can. And it comes back to an issue that you raised earlier, and it was, I think you said something to the effect that wouldn't everybody expect that they'd be less happy and that they'd have more problems in relationships if they were facing a great deal of stress.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, people don't realize that. If a husband or a wife loses his or her job, and it's a job that contributes very significantly to the maintenance of the family, people don't know exactly how they're going to respond to that. We're not very good observers of our own behavior. So as we perhaps become more angry, or we become more depressed, or we become more anxious, we're not always aware of that. And we're not always aware of how those kinds of feelings of distress may influence our interactions with other people. But we do know that those kinds of emotional problems have a negative impact on the way we treat not only ourselves, but on the way we treat those who are around us, including our spouses and our children. So I think that if we arm people ahead of time, you know, what to do when you lose your job, if we arm people ahead of time to be aware of the kinds of emotional changes they may experience and the kinds of impacts that may have on their relationships with the people they're closest to, I think that that can help reduce the impact of some of these stressors, because most of them are short-term. Most of them don't last a lifetime. They occur and they're overcome.
We are at our midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. Very quickly, just let me introduce again our guest, Rand Conger. He's Distinguished Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of California, Davis. He's also a research collaborator with the title Professor of Psychology at Iowa State University, and has been a faculty member at University of Georgia, here at U of I, Urbana-Champaign, and also Iowa State. And we're talking in part about some of the kind of work that he's been involved in now going back a couple of decades, starting in Iowa, in rural Iowa, taking a look at families that were dealing with financial pressure as a result of the downturn in the farm economy. And they had the opportunity to do a longitudinal kind of studies looking at some of the people that would have been kids or adolescents at that time when this study started, who now are in their 30s, now have families of their own, and trying to look long-term at why it is that some families can weather the pressures and others not, and what are the important factors in being able to do that. They've also done work, this would have been families living in rural areas. They've also looked at African-American families in urban areas. They've done some work also in California looking at Mexican-American families, and have found essentially that the issues pretty much are the same. It doesn't matter what kind of ethnic background a family comes from, and maybe even doesn't matter what kind of economic background they start out with, that the kinds of pressures that we're talking about, particularly economic pressures, they tend to affect families very similarly. And when you ask this question, why can some weather the storm and others not, really it's the factors are very much the same, no matter what kind of makeup of the family we're talking about. Questions are certainly welcome. Anybody wants to get involved in the conversation can call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about is the adolescence in these families, and what, you know, was it likely that in families that were going through tough times that this was this would get translated into, use the phrase, problematic behaviors on the part of their teenage kids?
Yes, the evidence is that if the economic pressures led to worsening relationships between parents, led to high levels of emotional distress by parents, those two kinds of processes disrupt effective parenting behaviors. Under those kinds of pressures, parents tend to withdraw from parenting. They don't spend as much time working with their children to help them succeed in school and help them succeed in social activities. They are more likely to be angry and irritable. They're more likely to snap at their adolescents if they're irritated by them. So you have a situation in which the parent tends to be withdrawn from the child, but when they do interact with the child, it's more likely to be a negative type of interaction than one that is supportive and helpful. Under those circumstances, we find that adolescents are more likely to themselves experience psychological problems like anxiety or depression. They're more likely to get involved in delinquent or antisocial activities, to get involved with substances of one type or another, or early onset sexual activities. They're also less likely to demonstrate competencies. They're less likely to succeed in school. They're less likely to develop close and supportive relationships with conventional peers. So there can be a great deal of harm done in this family economic stress process.
Mm-hmm. So is it, how much of this, I wonder, has to do with the fact that that parents are not, because they may be, in a sense, distracted because they have a lot of worries. Maybe they're having basic kinds of worries about how it is they're going to pay the bills and feed the family and keep a roof over their head, that they're not as engaged with their children as maybe as they, as much engaged as they should be or they want to. When they do enter, and perhaps on top of that, when they do interact, it may be not a positive interaction, but that somehow it's just the worries and the stresses on the parents contributes to a kind of distance and disengagement from their children, and that's it has a lot to do with why their kids might then go out and get into trouble.
That's exactly right. That's a large part of the problem. I can give you some illustrations. I remember one farm family that we were studying, and the husband in the family and the kids in the family were describing the kinds of processes that were going on. The father was in a situation where he didn't know whether or not he was going to be able to keep his farm. He was bordering on the edge of bankruptcy, and he really didn't know whether he would still have a farm or whether he was going to be able to make a living in farming. And he described a situation where he would spend his afternoons laying on the couch eating potato chips and just laying there worrying because there seemed to be nothing he could do to change his situation. And the children would come home and they would say that if their father did anything, he would yell at them for one thing or another, for not doing chores or not getting one thing or another done, and just express a great deal of irritability. These were the behaviors that were quite contrary to what had existed in the family before this looming bankruptcy was threatening them. So those are the kinds of changes that we see in families. Husbands and wives will report the same thing. If you probe in depth and you ask, what's your marriage like now compared to what it was before you started experiencing these economic difficulties? They'll say things like, well, we just yell at each other a lot more than we used to. And so those kinds of emotional problems and irritable exchanges lead to withdrawal, lead to to people coming apart and not investing time and effort in one another as they did before the problem started.
Mm-hmm. I think that in as much as psychologists and people in education and so forth have been studying family dynamics for a long time, it seems that maybe we have some clues about how things go wrong but that the more interesting and perhaps more difficult questions happen to be, what happens when things go right? That is, what is it that parents who are doing a good job are doing? And it may seem, and maybe you'd say that, no, I've got that wrong, but it somehow seems to me that perhaps we're a little bit better at diagnosing problems than we are at being positive, in the sense that we would say, we can tell you what to do, what you should be doing. It's clear we tell you what you shouldn't be doing, but that it seems that it's a little bit more difficult to talk about what it is that good parents are doing right.
Well, I think you're correct, although fortunately there is a good deal of research, including some that we've done now with the families we've been studying, where we have identified many characteristics of parents that will benefit their children. You know, investing time and energy in your children is important. Setting appropriate standards for their behavior is important, and monitoring and providing appropriate consequences when those standards are met or when they're not met is extremely important. Children need to know that you're paying attention and that you will provide some kinds of appropriate responses if they do what they're supposed to do, and that you'll also be willing to discipline if needed if they are violating the rules and not doing well. So I think we know a great deal about what parents can do that will be helpful. Love and affection is an important part of that as well. It's not only a matter of setting consequences and being sure that, or setting standards and providing appropriate consequences, but you also have to let kids know that you appreciate them and care about them and that you are invested in their lives. Mm-hmm. The problem is that in so many circumstances, even when we can deliver information about things parents should do to be effective in raising their children, the whole environment around them undermines their ability to do that. So, for example, if you're faced with enormous economic stresses and it's causing you to become seriously depressed and anxious and irritable, it may well take a psychological intervention designed to help you overcome, well, a psychological and perhaps a social intervention in terms of helping to relieve your economic pressure, but a psychological intervention as well to help you relieve some of those symptoms of anxiety and depression before you will be able to engage in the effective kinds of parenting behavior that we know about. Or if your marriage is falling apart and you're having a great deal of stress and strain in terms of your relationship with your spouse, that too will be distracting, pull you away from investing in the lives of your children. And there again, it becomes very difficult to engage in the kinds of effective parenting behaviors that we know about. So it's not just a matter of delivering a parenting program. It's also a matter of helping to create an environment, both a psychological and a social or economic environment, in which those parenting behaviors can be exercised.
We have a caller to bring in, Tawasa. Why don't we do that? Someone on our line one in Aurora, right here. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Hi.
I went through, my two sisters and I went through all that he's talking about. My father got sick, and so my mother was the only worker in the family, and she broke a picket line to get a job. It was the only thing she could do, and she did it. She was exhausted. She slept every Sunday. The whole day she slept. And we knew not to bother her, wake her up or anything. And there were many meals that we didn't have. We ate what they ate those days. I was telling my daughter, I don't think she believed me, we ate bread with lard on it. That's what we had, so we ate it. We ate other good things that are not eaten today, like liver. People don't eat it today, but we ate it during the Depression. And we always had vegetables. My mother saw to that. It was a tough time. It was a tough, tough time. And you can't explain it to anybody that hasn't lived through it. Only somebody who has lived through it knows the real tough times when we couldn't pay the rent, so we had to move. There was nothing else to do. We had to move. And there was one thing that happened that I can't even tell you about because you'd never believe me. It was a tough, tough time. I don't know what the author, what had you hoped to find out of your program that you're writing?
Well, we had hoped to find the different strategies that families use that help them most successfully weather those very difficult times. It sounds to me like you were dealing with two huge different sources of stress, a father who was seriously ill and economic problems all at the same time. Oftentimes, people who are, particularly in our study, both parents were physically capable. It's just that the economy in rural areas had been seriously damaged by the drop in the value of farmland and the drop in the value of farm commodities, and so they had to fight their way out of that. But it oftentimes didn't occur within the context of another major stressor like a significant illness in the family.
And but my mother always voted. My mother voted every year. She voted whenever she could and should. She voted because she told me in Europe, where she came from, they didn't allow you to vote unless you owned property. So when she came here, she voted. And, of course, I have followed suit, and my children have done the same. But all her children graduated from high school. And that was quite something in those days to graduate from high school. And we just did. We just did. We knew we were supposed to, and we just did. When I see that, and now the high school I went to, we had what they call one diploma, and you graduated and got that diploma. But now you can get two diplomas. You can either get the one, which is, I forget the term for it, the best diploma, or they have made a second diploma which doesn't ask for the criteria that the first diploma. I'm not wording this as correctly as I would like to, but it was a lesser diploma. So America has lowered its standards, and I think that's terrible, to lower America's standards.
Although in Europe there are in Europe and England there are also separate tracks for secondary education. I'm not familiar with the two different kinds of diplomas that you're talking about, but in Europe some people choose not to go into the university track; they go into more of a vocational track.
Yes, and I see that as a vocational. Yes, I see that because some people that's their areas of expertise, and why shouldn't they use that area? Yeah, but I guess I just see the dumbing of America, and I hate to see it. I just think it's the dumbing of America. Well, thank you for a wonderful program.
Okay. All right, thanks for the call. Why don't we just go and we'll talk with someone next in Charleston, Illinois, on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
I'll try to make this short, but the social organization that we live under now, under imperialized capitalism, which then replaced, and this is where I'll try to keep it short, replaced the tribalism had already been knocked out. And there are examples of that, you know, still exist, but it's not widespread. But then when the extended family was eliminated in between 1900 and 1940, a whole different sort of circumstances took place now with the nuclear family. And then all the problems that your guest has been articulating stem now from that paradigm by which the one-on-one and under depressed and or excess or under ordinary conditions of fulfilling one's daily needs of air, water, and food and some sort of housing now has been pinched down very, very close. and the ability to survive in that, especially when the father figure declines and goes out of business or never did get into business. We are raising children and passing on to them through their four stages of development in threes, three events: infancy, childhood, juvenile, and adult, which we never reach adulthood. And I'll hang up and listen for your answer.
Well, I don't know what that you can what we can pick up out of that. I guess I am interested. Well, obviously, you, Professor Conger, you can respond to that any way you like. But I guess I'm interested in the caller's point about moving from more of a time of an extended family to the time of the nuclear family, and whether you had found whether there families that were having trouble, were they able to, were there other family members they could reach out to for assistance, or they felt that it was kind of them all alone and they had to solve the problems, whatever problems they have, all by themselves?
I think that extended families can be very important, and we certainly find in rural areas more than urban areas, at least rural agricultural areas, typically families living more closely together. For example, grandparents being more involved in the raising of grandchildren. And we see a lot of that in rural Iowa and not so much of that in urban areas that we study. There's a real effort to stay closer together in some of these extended family systems. But, you know, an extended family can operate to your benefit, and an extended family can also operate to your detriment. And let me give you an example. In rural Iowa at the time that we were going through the farm crisis years, grandparents, the parents of the parents of our cohort of adolescents in our study, would often lend money or sign notes, co-sign notes, for the parents in our study. So let's say a parent in our study had a farm and they needed to borrow additional money in order to keep that farm going. They might go to their parents and ask for assistance and have a co-sign note. And that happened quite frequently, actually. In many of these cases, those notes really should never have been co-signed. In reality, the farm economy was so bad, the farm was lost, and it was just a matter of delaying bankruptcy rather than actually avoiding bankruptcy. But in any case, oftentimes the parents in our study ended up working several different jobs so that they wouldn't have to default on those co-signed notes, because if they defaulted on the co-signed notes, then their parents would not have a retirement. So it can become extremely complex. And in many cases, economically, parents in our study would have been better off to have declared bankruptcy than to have gone to their parents for assistance with these loans. So extended family can be very helpful, but extended family can also generate or sustain problems, even when they're intending to do good. Sometimes if you look at child abuse situations, the person who's abusing a child may well have come from an extended family where abuse of children was fairly common. So drawing on that extended family may in fact increase the probability that they will abuse their own children. So I agree with the caller that there are many benefits that can accrue from extended families. And actually, in many low-income urban areas right now, involvement of an extended family is quite common. But it can work in both directions. Yeah. It can be helpful, and it can be a hindrance as well.
I'm sure that probably most people who have children, if you asked them if they were honest, they would say they weren't prepared. They really weren't ready. Maybe they thought that they were, but it's kind of hard to know what it's going to be like and how you're going to deal with the challenge until you're in it. Having said that, though, I think that there are also people who believe that it would probably be a good idea if somehow we could figure out a way. I suppose the best way to do it would be within school, to work in some kind of, in a formal sense, some kind of parent education. Although this, it becomes very quickly controversial, because people might have different ideas about how you raise children. And managing to satisfy everybody or not step on anybody's toes might be kind of difficult. But what is the thinking these days among people who do research on families about that very issue and whether it's possible and how you would do it to try to do more parent education so that people would have at least a little bit of knowledge, a base of knowledge, before they become parents.
Well, you're absolutely correct. There should be a great deal more about parent education in the schools, and it should be based on good scientific evidence. We don't have any problem teaching about biology from studies of biological processes, and we shouldn't have any problem teaching about what types of parenting seem to be most effective in terms of raising competent children, as long as the evidence for those kinds of educational programs is based on legitimate and well-validated scientific studies. I think done that way, somebody can always say, well, it wasn't that way in my family and I turned out just fine. And that's true. Oftentimes people will turn out fine no matter what their parents do. But on average, we can say that if parents engage in certain kinds of behaviors involving nurturing and affection for children while at the same time setting appropriate standards and having appropriate consequences if those standards aren't met or are met, kids do pretty well. They do quite well. And it would be perfectly appropriate to teach those kinds of lessons in school and to have them based on good scientific evidence.
And you can do that in a way that would make it neutral enough so that that wouldn't be a source of controversy?
Well, it may be a source of controversy. I mean, if you're living in a small community where people think that kids ought to be hit in the head with sticks if they do things that are wrong, it would be very hard to overcome that kind of general bias in a small town. But I think the way you sell the idea is that you're presenting information based on good, valid, legitimate scientific studies, just as you would get evidence based on biological processes based on good, legitimate biological studies. But of course, even there, you run into different kinds of beliefs. Witness the movement toward creationism and so on, and the worries about Darwin's theory, which seems to be pretty well validated within the scientific world. Mm-hmm. So you can always run into problems, but I think on average you can probably develop programs that are based on good scientific evidence.
Are there places you know that they actually have done this?
Well, we do have educational programs, some of which have been developed in our own from our own research, that are extended out into the community, sometimes through cooperative extension, sometimes through churches or other community organizations, medical organizations, that take some of the principles that we've and other people have learned and provide parent education programs. And these are quite common now and actually have been demonstrated to be quite effective. They haven't been institutionalized as much as they might be through the public school system, and I think that would be the next reasonable step.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ed, we're just about at the point where we have to finish. Maybe we have a minute or two left. We've talked about a number of things, both on a kind of a theoretical and a kind of a practical level. I guess I'm interested in what you would like to leave people with that you would say, here's something important that in the time that we've been doing this kind of work that we have learned. It might be something that would seem obvious, but it's a good thing for us to keep in mind when we're looking at this issue of, you know, healthy families versus dysfunctional families and what really makes the difference.
In our studies, I think one of the most important lessons that we've learned is that when parents step back and say, what's really the priority for us? What's the priority in our lives? If when they answer that question, it's the priority is maintaining our family and our family relationships and finding effective ways of doing that, they generally tend to do pretty well. If their priority is primarily making a lot of money or being a success financially in the community, then they're probably going to have problems, and the health of the family may well be jeopardized.
Hmm. Well, I think at that point we're pretty much going to have to finish. If people are interested in maybe looking at some of this research, would you suggest they look at Children of the Land, that book?
I think Children of the Land is a good book. We also have a book out called Families in Troubled Times that came out, I think, in 1994. But Children of the Land is a good book, and Families in Troubled Times is also a helpful book.
All right. And that book, Children of the Land, the subtitle is Adversity and Success in Rural America, which looks at some of that research that we have talked about.
Absolutely.
Well, Professor Conger, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.